Good morning, everybody. We're calling the meeting of the Board of Techno Registration to order. Mr. Winters, if you'd please do a roll call.
Dr. Alejandro Angel.
Here.
Jack Gilmore.
Present.
Neil Jones.
Here.
Jason Foose.
Here.
Jason Madison.
Yep.
Carmen Wyckoff.
Here.
Stephen Knoll. Andrew Everode.
Here.
Eugene Montgomery.
Here.
We have a quorum.
Thank you. We'll start with a call to the public. Members of the public may address the board during this call to the public for no more than 3 minutes. Pursuant to ARS, the board members are not allowed to discuss or take legal actions on matters raised during an open call to the public unless the matters are properly noticed for discussion legal action. However, members may ask staff to review a matter or may ask that the matter be placed on a future agenda. So with that, is anybody interested in addressing the board on an item that is not on the agenda already? Okay, we will proceed with the meeting then. I believe we might have some items that we can consent if we have a long agenda. Is there any... Oh, sorry, there are no minutes from last month, are there?
Minutes are deferred until February.
Okay, so there are no minutes for adoption. And there are no cases for formal hearing today. So we'll move into enforcement matters, where we have about 25 of them.
I just had A1 sign in.
Okay. So we'll start with item 6A1 then. This is a complaint against Todd Springer of Mechanical PE in reference to the Portland Place versus ProChem Tech International case or site. So is Mr. Springer here? Or
Mr. Ledger? Keister's here.
Thank you, Mr. Keister. Is he here?
Yes.
Okay, would you please state your name for the record, sir?
Timothy Keister.
Thank you, Mr. Keister. And is there anything you'd like to say to the board today as we consider this case?
Yes, I have a brief statement I'd like to read.
Yes, sir, absolutely.
Okay, I'm Timothy Keister. I'm the chief chemist and owner of ProChem Tech International. I've been employed in the water and wastewater field for approximately 41 years. I'm a certified water technologist, fellow of the American Institute of Chemical Engineers, emeritus member of the American Institute of Chemists, active member of the Association of Water Technologists, Technical and Certification Committees, also a member of the Kuntai Technology Institute, Water Environment Federation, American Chemical Society, and ASHRAE. The present case presents an obvious case of malpractice due to the following. Mr. Springer and his employer presented themselves as experts in a lawsuit involving corrosion failure of a cooling tower. Mr. Springer's opinions to the plaintiff resulted in the filing of a lawsuit against my company. Typically, we would refer such to our insurance company. However, based on a similar case several years ago, I decided to fight this technically baseless case. To date, my firm has spent $70,000 on legal and expert witness fees. The opinion advanced by Mr. Springer that the South Cooling Tower failed due to an acid cleaning conducted about 8 years prior to the failure, obvious in error, as the North Cooling Tower, which was subjected to the same acid cleaning, continues in service to the present day. Our retained expert, Robert Cunningham, PE, Corrosion Engineering, a gentleman with 51 years of experience, is of the opinion that the corrosion failure was due to under-deposit corrosion resulting from failure of the plaintiff to undertake required routine maintenance. My own review of the cooling tower failure is in agreement with Mr. Cunningham. To be considered an expert, one must have specific knowledge, skill, experience, training, and education in the specific area under consideration. Mr. Springer fails to meet any of the criteria to be considered an expert in the present case where a cooling tower failed due to corrosion. As demonstrated in his deposition, He has no knowledge, skill, expertise, experience, training, or education in the technical issues of the case, which would involve acid cleaning, corrosion, water treatment service, water treatment chemistry, or preventative maintenance of cooling towers. Based on the facts, Mr. Springer clearly agreed to undertake an engagement outside of his experience and qualifications, and Mr. Springer clearly lacked the knowledge, skill, experience, training, and education to correctly complete the engagement. I have to apologize. I just walked in here because there's a wreck on 7th Street, and I had to detour around a bit. I would have been here about 15 minutes earlier.
I did
too. Okay. Thank you, sir. We'll open up the case for discussion.
Yeah,
if there's any.
Mr. Chairman, yes. When I read the particulars of this case, I had actually initially agreed with the assessor, Adam Blevin, in that being a mechanical engineer myself, I probably would have consulted with a metallurgist or at least a water chemist in that he did, as the gentleman indicated, not have those skill sets when performing the forensic failure analysis. I mean, it appeared superficially, again, I didn't have the ability to do any metallurgical or cross-sectional analysis of the failure, but it did empirically look like pit corrosion due to perhaps a chloride attack, due to a scale buildup. As the gentleman was indicating, the acid wash was a mild, citric acid solution applied to both north and south cooling towers, which would have had a uniform attack or etching on the tubes and not biased towards the top and left the bottom relatively unaffected. Whereas the argument of the other expert in water chemistry seemed to provide a more plausible explanation. However, after reviewing the EAC meeting minutes, the discussion did not center so much on the technical merits. They indicated that that should be argued in court, that the expert witnesses can clash with each other and they need to be adjudicated. The EAC concluded that it is within the realm of a licensed engineer to accept assignment, outside his purview to the extent that he feels he's qualified to make that assessment. In this case, the mechanical engineer felt he was qualified. He came to a conclusion. He wrote a report, sealed it, and submitted it as expert findings. And perhaps he's wrong, and that may well be proven out in court, as the gentleman explained. But I don't think, to the extent of our Arizona regulations, he's performing malpractice. I mean, as we'll get to another case on our agenda later today where a mechanical engineer practiced structural engineering outside of his purview, and he had a restriction on his practice, in fact. I don't know to what extent we want to restrain this gentleman's practice, to not perform water chemistry analysis again like we did in the settlement agreement with that agenda item. I would just, to get to the point, I would probably would want a letter of concern or some notice, bringing this to his attention. I mean, dismissing the case, may be too soft. But that's my opinion. I would think that we should at least, provide a cautionary note to him to indicate that, your practice should reflect your expertise. But so far as who's right and who's wrong, I don't think it's the board's decision to make that technical judgment. At this juncture.
Any other opinions, thoughts? I think part of it is this is within the bounds of a court case, as you said, and I think in those cases it's up to the court to determine the whether an individual is actually an expert or not, and to weigh their testimony based on that. Is that correct,
Mr. Everett? I agree.
Okay. So I think that the technical items are a little bit, the technical merits are a little bit outside of the board scope. The question is this person practicing well outside their area of expertise? And I'm hesitant to overreach because we do have an EAC who was convinced, and that was three professionals who were convinced that he did have relevant knowledge. He also submitted, the respondent submitted a letter where he explains his qualifications. So I would be careful to do something. I could be persuaded to do a letter of concern to remind them that, you know, he can only do work in other areas to the extent that they're incidental to their to his category of registration. But I don't know that we can go beyond that in
no,
this
I wouldn't,
case.
I would, excuse me, yes, Mr. Chairman, I agree with that. I would not go beyond that. I mean, the maximum extent would be just as, disciplinary letter. It's just a letter of concern at the most. But if you know the board is not inclined to even go that far, you know I'm not so strong as to put any limitations. I mean I have, in fact, in my own work practice, worked on condensers, worked on corrosion products, and failure analysis. But I've always engaged the necessary expertise of metallurgists and laboratories to back up my my claim. In this case, he did not. I believe he did not do any chemical scale analysis or metallurgical analysis of the substrate on the tube itself. So, you know, it's just a cautionary note. It's to beware of your boundaries when you perform these forensic analysis.
Yes, sir.
I would point out that the judge in this case in December had already excluded Mr. Springer as an expert.
Okay.
So whether who's right or who's wrong on that, the judge has already made a determination that he's not an expert. And this complaint was filed because I think he is operating far outside of his area of expertise. The gentleman's qualified to testify on fires and things like that. I have his resume here. The poor gentleman does not have any knowledge in the water treatment chemistry or the water management field at all.
Okay. I understand. I'm still not persuaded that we should, personally, that we should change our mind. I think he, as a mechanical engineer, seems like the appropriate profession to evaluate the failure of a cooling tower. Then what the findings are, I think, might be outside his area of expertise, but that's where it's incidental to his main work, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Does anybody have other thoughts or want to make a motion or further discussion?
No, I'll be persuaded, Mr. Chairman, to accept the EAC conclusions. I mean, obviously, Mr. Blevins ultimately was convinced that it was an unsubstantiated allegation as well. And he was arguing along the same lines as I was just discussing earlier.
So
just to accept the motion to dismiss.
Are you making a motion to dismiss then?
Yeah.
Okay.
Second.
Okay, so we have a motion and a second to dismiss the allegation. Is there any more discussion? Okay, let's vote on the motion. All in favor of dismissal?
Aye.
Opposed? Mr. Keister, we appreciate your time and certainly putting up with traffic and everything else. So, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, in light of the large group of speakers we have here today, I'm going to make a motion that we consent items B1, B2, D1, D3, D4, D5, and that's it.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess, you're making a motion?
I'm making a motion to consent those items as offered by staff or under the conditions offered by staff.
Second that, Chair.
Okay. Does anybody have any questions on that?
So which ones are you doing again?
Yeah. B1.
B1, B2.
B2.
D1.
D1.
D3.
D3.
D4. D5.
D4, D5.
Okay. I'm okay with that.
I'm okay with those as well. Let's make sure everybody gets a chance to review. And I don't believe anybody's here to speak on those items, correct? Because if you're here and you'd like to be heard on those, that's 6B1, 6B2, D1, D3, and D4. And let me actually let you know which cases those are in case you're here for one of them. What's that?
And D5.
My bad, D5, correct. So here's the, this is the William Reed case, Patrick Zechet case, Edward Robles, Stephen Anderson, Joel Kramer, and Thomas Denton. That's what we're looking at, consenting. Okay. We have a motion and a second. Are we ready to vote?
Mm-hmm.
All in favor of consenting those items?
Aye.
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 Opposed? Okay, motion passes. Then we'll start going through cases where people are here. Let's start with 6C1. This is case number is P18040. Respondent is Stephen Franny, a registered architect with IPS engineers and architects. Yep. Has he? Has this consent agreement been signed already?
Fine.
Mr. Hunt? Okay. Thank you. That's the one he told me about. Is Mr. Franny or anybody else in this case here?
Mr. Franny is available by phone if you have questions for him.
Okay.
He's in Pennsylvania, so.
Okay. Does anybody have any questions for Mr. Franny?
I don't. I move that we accept the signed consent agreement.
Second.
Okay. We have a motion and a second. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, motion passes. We will go to 6C2, which is case number P18073. This is the case of Richard Moore, registered architect, in RMA Design Group. The complaint is for a practice of a more regulated profession without registration. And you have the packet in front of you. Would you please identify yourself for the board, sir?
Richard Moore, RMA Design Group.
Thank you, Mr. Moore. And we have a consent agreement offered to Mr. Moore that includes a letter of reprimand, a $500 administrative penalty, and a $130 cost of investigation. So, Mr. Moore, if you have any questions or would like to say anything to the board?
No.
Okay. Does anybody want to discuss this case?
I'll make a motion that we offer.
Okay. So we have a motion to offer the consent.
If not signed in 30 days, proceed to formal hearing.
Okay. Do we have a second?
I'll second that, Chair.
Okay. Any discussion?
So was this a firm that was never registered, or is this one that expired?
2015. Records indicate.
It used to be registered, and it lapsed in 2015.
Okay.
And are you current at this point, Mr. Moore?
I am.
Okay. Thank you. And I think there were also some concerns about technical skill in the original complaint, and those were dismissed. So there were no issues with the technical work. It's, at this point, the case is purely about the lack of registration for the firm.
And, Mr. Chairman, and the respondent agrees with the fine.
The respondent has not signed the consent agreement, so I don't know if he agrees or disagrees with the fine.
Okay.
I don't think we are offering him the consent. Mr. Moore, you have the opportunity to accept it, or you can go to a hearing on your case.
Yeah, the big thing, I just want to make sure that we're being, you know, across the board, you know, registered, not registered firms, that, you know, the penalties are, the administrative penalties are the same.
So I believe last board meeting, we mentioned 250 as a baseline of like an oops a couple months out, and then 500 when it's more than that couple months, which it appears to be in keeping here.
And then we did D4, which was basically the similar, and it was a 500, so.
Yeah, and the fact that he was registered at one point and it lapsed, it's not that he didn't know.
That he didn't know.
Mr. Moore, so just so you understand the process, the board is going to offer you a consent agreement with what I mentioned. That's the $500 fine, cost of investigation, and a letter of reprimand. You can choose to accept it, or you can decline and take your case to hearing and wait what the outcome would be. So,
I'll accept.
You don't have to, but we appreciate it. You don't have to right now. So you can coordinate with staff.
All right.
Okay. We have a motion and a second. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Thank you, Mr. Moore. We will move to agenda item 6C3. This is case number P18048. Respondent is Mark Orr, civil PE, and it's in regard to the Holzenbach Residence Canopies Project in Tonopah, Arizona. This was about a carport and some other, you know, site structures that had been built without permits, and then I think Mr. Orr and another engineer designed changes to those structures to get permits and make them compliant. And I think later it was argued that Mr. Orr's calculation were deficient in a few ways. There were also discussion about potentially having done or aiding and abetting non-registrant. So let me summarize the conclusions were that the respondent, Mr. Orr, failed to apply appropriate technical knowledge and skill, and that he aided and abetted an unregistered person. Staff recommendation is a letter of reprimand, restriction of practice on structural engineering, administrative penalty of $2,000, and cost of investigation of $419. So that's where we're at right now. Mr. Orr, is there anything you'd like to say to the board, sir?
Yes, I would. Do I need to wait for Sean, or?
Where did he go?
He stepped out with the last guy. So to talk with Mr. Orr.
Okay. Just tell us everything. You said it was fine, right? You said it was no big deal. No, go ahead. Here's Sean.
There he is.
Sorry about that.
So for the record, I'm Mark Orr, licensed civil engineer. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I'd like to just recap a couple of things that went on during this project that, well, maybe shed a little light on it, maybe not. My company received the job to complete repairs for the project, for the existing structure, the carport, and the RV carport in May of 2017. Due to Mr. Halsenbach's medical conditions, he unknowingly hired two engineers, myself and the alleger, Mr. James Lane, to complete the work. The Halsenbachs refused to pay Mr. Lane due to overdesign of the repairs. Reportedly out of concern for public safety, Mr. Lane contacted Maricopa County to inform them of the issue, and they informed him that it had already been closed and permits had already, or the plans had already been submitted and everything was closed. So he contacted me and asked if I could give him a copy of the calculations. So I gave him a copy of the calculations where he did a quick little review and immediately said, you're in error and I want you to call Maricopa County and rescind your seal immediately. And I'm like, well, I need additional time. I'm a little busy at the moment. I need to reassess the calculations and drawings to make sure if there were any errors and correct them. I informed him that we had already made repairs, or the repairs had already been completed to the project, and reinforcing of the existing beams and columns and everything was done. And he still was pretty adamant that I take care of it, and I just did not get a chance to review the drawings and calculations before he turned me into the state board. Once I had got out there to actually review the project and verify that everything was done correctly, we actually found an error with the carport. The carport was actually specified to be bigger than what it actually was. So when we reran the calculations, I found that everything on the carports worked, and I do not, I accept fault for missing the wind uplift on this and not calculating the wind uplift initially. But when we reviewed it, we did do the wind uplift calculations and ended up adding a couple of reinforcing bars underneath that mid-span of the joist and adding a couple of footings in order to reinforce it. We also revised all the plans and calculations, as you have seen, and sent, gave them to the Halsenbecks and had them go down to Maricopa County to be compliant. And Maricopa County said, no, we're not going to accept these bars because you've already closed a permit. Have a good day. So, you know, I take responsibility for the errors that I did during the course of this project and corrected them when they were brought to my attention that there was an error. And again, the repairs were completed to make sure that the buildings were compliant and per code. A restriction on my license will affect my current position with my employer, as I am the responsible engineer in charge for projects that include structural design and assessment for forensic analysis. I've been a licensed professional engineer since 2006 with no complaints under any jurisdiction, and I am licensed in 6 states. And I accept responsibility for the charges brought against me and request leniency regarding the restrictions submitted to the board by Mr. Peck.
Thank you, sir. I have a couple of quick questions for you, and then I'll turn up for the board. One question. So the structures have been retrofitted, correct?
Okay.
Secondly, who was your contract with, Mr. Orr? Was your contract with the Halsenbeck or with Mr. Murphy?
No, the Halsenbeck. They hired us directly. And that's another part. I do admit that I, you know, stamped it, but I didn't know that I was not, was doing it incorrect. Okay. And I only signed the structural portions of the project.
And my last initial question was, in terms of the wind load, I think I appreciate you taking ownership of the fact that you missed it, but it seems like it's a pretty basic thing in structural engineering to calculate the wind load, especially for a carport. So why did you miss it?
One, it had been in, I don't know, I don't really have a good answer for that. Yeah, I just missed it.
Okay. Mr. Chair, is that part of building code for the structure?
Yeah.
Yes, it would be a required building code load.
Sure. My concern is that I can only see two possible explanations to that. I mean, it's one, you don't know structural engineering, or two, you did not look at the calculations. Unless there's a third one that I'm not aware of, but those are the two I can think of.
Well, I just missed it. I didn't see that he had, that we had forgotten to do the uplift. Part of it was probably because I was thinking it's an existing structure and it's been there for several years and didn't think twice about it. Because there was no wind damage to it. You know, there's no uplift damage, no removal of the panels, nothing. And I do a lot of forensic investigations in the 6 states that I'm licensed in. And so, I mean, I see wind damage on a regular basis. And this was primarily a gravity issue where when the homeowner built the carports, he used 3-inch diameter steel pipe for a beam spanning 20 feet. And so by the time we got out there, it was sagging pretty good, but there was, again, no wind damage, and footings verified and everything else. So
I'll open it up for discussion of the technical merits of the case, and Jason, I'm looking at you in particular, but the other item that came up was the aiding and abetting charge. I think we should have discussion on that. My understanding is, and from what you said, you were working for the property owner, and you said, Mr., what was the name of your...
Haro,
that he works under contract for you.
Yes.
So I'm not sure that I see aiding and abetting in that sense, because he contracted with the owner of the house and wasn't responsible charge. Mr. Haro received contractor duties from, or contractor monies from him through a 1099. So he wasn't an employee, but he, you know, that's one of, I think that's one of the items for bona fide employee is to get contract compensation. The only thing that would give me pause is if he was taking direction from Mr. Murphy, or, you know, and the one thing that gives me pause is that you didn't even check the drawings to go out there and see if they represented what was in the field, and that turned out to be very different.
Yes, so. And that's, you know, it's common for a design to come into your office, and based on the designer's drawings that he gives you, you're going to calculate it appropriately. Obviously, errors made, and then errors corrected. But, you know, had Mr. Lane given me enough time to get out there and take care of this problem, I probably wouldn't be sitting in front of you either. And he, you know, another thing with Mr. Lane is he did take the Halls and Becks to small claims court, ended up getting paid for the job that they didn't use.
And I think the excuse that the owner didn't know that they hired two engineers is made up. Because there's plenty of correspondence from the wife of who didn't have a stroke while he was doing the work all the way through contract work proceeding and completion. So
she
they knew
he
was engaged.
She didn't know that he did it, though. She had no idea that.
She got it, and I think, okay. Be that as, I think the Lane issue is independent. The question here is about your technical skill.
Yes, absolutely.
And the bona fide employee issue or aiding and abetting. So, yes. Yeah, thanks, Mr. Thor.
I just want to bring to the board attention that it's more than just the failure of the structure. It's the potential impact to public health and safety if that carport or RV shell structure would have gone airborne. So it's a public hazard, actually, just beyond the structural failure.
Right, and I appreciate that he made the corrections, but the only reason he made the corrections was because another engineer who happened to be on the project brought it up to him that this stuff is wrong. So the corrections were made, but had there not been another engineer on it, they would have never been made, and we would have had a, you know, non-code compliant structure out there.
It might have actually saved you some liability.
Yeah, right. The issue with the not going out in the field and verifying what's there, I can see that, but sometimes if it's an existing structure, you probably should have put some eyes on it, you know, to see what was actually there and what was actually done. Since you were relying on a drafter that wasn't, you know, a designer that wasn't yours, or, you know, to do something for you that you really, I don't believe you ever had a working relationship with him before that, so.
And I don't disagree with that comment.
Yeah. I understand the restriction of practice, and, you know, maybe it's, maybe we could consider, some training
or
something like that.
Can we do a state restriction of practice where he can continue to practice for a year or something along those lines until he passes his structural PE? So not to keep him from practicing now, but if he can't pass a structural PE within a year or a certain amount of time, then I think that would be cause for concern for him to continue to practice, and we would at that point lift the stay. Mr. Orr.
I do complete additional continuing education for the other four licenses that I have in other states. You know, obviously Arizona and Colorado that I'm licensed in do not require continuing education, but the four of the other states that I am in, I do. And I just got done with 32 credits for those licenses. So I do continuously keep up with continuing education on a regular basis to continue forward.
I guess my concern is wind loading is probably the most basic thing besides gravity loading that you have to, you know, evaluate and determine. And straight uplift is, you know, one of the simplest calculations you can do.
Yes.
I agree. I do have some concerns with, you know, with the practice structure being completed. This is something high tech or something to be like, okay, you know, maybe, but wind load is right at the beginning of the, you know, the loading of the chapter of the building code. So,
and just to state, there were no failures of this. I mean, we did make the repairs, and there was no wind damage to the structure, both structures that were reinforced.
Well, they have been standing without anything for 10 years, but the problem is, you know, there's a wind load because you never know when it's coming. It could be tomorrow, it could be 20 years from now. Go ahead, Carmen.
Is part of the question that what's ancillary to civil engineering?
Well, civil engineers can practice structural engineering in Arizona without a structural license.
I appreciate that. Thanks.
Yeah. Unless we have reason to believe they're not qualified to practice structural engineering.
Thanks for clarifying.
Yeah.
And we could do a peer review as well.
The question is, how severe is this?
Structural projects. Well, yeah, I believe it's pretty egregious for missing something so simplistic. I'll just repeat myself. It's not just the failure of the structure that concerns me. It's the impact liability to the public if this became airborne and damaged or injured, you know, a bystander, somebody unrelated to the design. Because there's no reason to believe that this would be a contained failure. It's not inside another superstructure. It's outdoors. So that's why I think it's a little bit more egregious than just a buckling or a collapse on the loading.
Restriction of practice.
But I'd also think we should throw some peer review in there as well.
Okay.
I do believe that's good. You know, and taking past the structural test. To continue to practice structural, but in the meantime, I think some peer review is probably warranted as well, just to make sure that in this year's time we don't have some other problem that comes up that hasn't been reviewed. I mean, luckily he had a peer review on this one, unknowing to him, but it happened to catch the issues that were out there.
Okay, so let me see if I can summarize what we've discussed so far. And correct me if anybody thinks differently, but the issue of aiding and abetting, in my mind, is fairly tenuous. Do we think it's something that he did commit or not commit? Or do we have enough evidence to know that he aided and abetted?
Mr. Chair, if I may, the board shouldn't be drawing legal conclusions at this point. If the board thinks there's enough evidence to proceed towards a hearing or to proceed on a certain issue, that's fine, but I would caution the board against reaching any kind of a conclusion on whether there's been any kind of a violation at this point. This isn't a hearing today.
Okay, so we can't discuss the merits of the case?
The board can certainly discuss the case at present, but I would caution against the road it appears to be.
I'm not trying to be difficult. I just don't understand what we... Because we're trying to establish one of the allegations that he aided and abetted an unregistered person.
Certainly.
Okay, how can I get to that without discussing it?
Did the EAC confirm that?
The EAC substantiated that, but in my opinion, they thought that Mr. Hare was not an employee of Mr. Orr, and that made him not qualified to be a bona fide employee, but if they received contract compensation, which he did on a 1099, or at least that's on the packet, he would be a bona fide employee.
Right. Okay, so the homeowners hired the engineer hired the drafter.
The owner hired both.
The owner hired the drafter.
Yes, they hired both of us independently.
Okay.
So.
Then I don't really see an aiding and abetting in that. He sealed and reviewed it and stamped it. He wasn't working for the drafter.
There's a third person involved, which is Mr. Harrow.
Right.
Mr. Harrow is a designer that works or receives contract compensation from Mr. Orr. I think he brought in the project to you, did he not?
Yes,
he did the initial calculations.
Yes, and then I reviewed.
That you reviewed.
Which I missed, obviously. Yeah. Sorry.
That makes sense, Jason?
No. Okay.
But the contract was with Mr. Orr. From the owner.
Right.
Even though it was referred to by Mr. Harrow, I think.
Correct.
Yes.
Mr. Harrow did the, so Mr. Harrow did the calculations and the drawings. Who
did the calculations? The drawings were a separate contract from the owner with Mr. Murphy.
Okay. So there was a contract for the drawings for Murphy. There was a contract for the calculations for Harrow, and that was by the owner as well?
Well, with Orr. The contract for the calculations was with Orr, but it was brought in by Harrow. Harrow was the one that, you know, the owner talked to Harrow and said, hey, we need calculations, or somebody talked to Harrow and said, we need calculations. He brought it to Mr. Orr, who signed a contract with the owner to do the calculations.
So, essentially, Harrow did the calculations for Mr. Orr at behest of the owner. Is that,
right. Yeah.
Does that no. seem to
then
follow?
Then I reviewed them, we stamped them, sent them to...
Then I would say, yeah, that's the way the money flowed, then, yeah, it's probably not.
Yeah. Money went to Orr and Orr to Harrow.
Right. Okay. Yeah. It wasn't the owner hired the Harrow and then Harrow hired Orr. It went to Orr. Okay.
Yeah.
Then I'd say yes. Then I wouldn't consider that aiding and abetting then, just because of the way the money path went.
Okay. So that's one issue. The other issue is the technical competence. And I think we're sympathetic to Mr. Orr's need to be registered for structural. At the same time, we're very concerned that this was a very basic issue. And what we have right now is on the consent agreement is a restriction of practice where you couldn't practice structural engineering until you passed your SAM. What we've been discussing is doing a stayed restriction of practice where we will allow you a year or a certain amount of time to take and pass the structural PE exam. Mm-hmm. If you do it, you can continue to practice structural. If you don't pass it in that period of time, then the restriction of practice becomes effective. I think what Mr. Madison was saying is potentially in the period of time requiring a couple of peer reviews to make sure that there's no harm. In the intervening year while you take the structural PE, there's a couple of peer reviews to make sure that your work is up to par.
Yes.
The structural PE is offered twice a year still?
Yes.
Okay. April and October.
Can I ask a question though? Is it the full 16-hour exam or... Okay.
Yes, sir.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, the 16-hour exam. So what do you think? I mean, we could even offer him, if we set to like June of 20, that's three opportunities to take it and pass it. April, mm-hmm. October, and April.
Yeah, I think as long as we have the peer reviews in there, like three peer reviews for the next three structural projects.
Are you going to make a motion?
So. I can. I'm not quite sure how to word it, but okay. So, offer consent agreement for letter of reprimand, stayed restriction of practice for what would be 18 months until such time that he takes and passes the structural NCWS structural exam, 16-hour structural exam, peer review on the next three. Project structural projects that are completed, administrative penalty in the amount of $2,000, cost of investigation in the amount of $419, not signed within 30 days, proceed to formal hearing.
Okay.
That
yes, paper? Sir.
Chair, one quick semantic question. The way it's expressed and the way it is up behind you on there, is this to be a restriction that'll be stayed 18 months before going into effect, or a stayed restriction where the restriction would be for an 18-month period?
It's a restriction that would be become in effect if he doesn't pass in the 18 months, but if he does pass before then, it would be lifted.
Right.
He wouldn't have any restrictions of practice.
I will ask one question. The time to register for the April exam may have passed with NCEES, I have to check, but if that's the case, then I would not be able to do April, and the earliest I would be able to do is October, so then it would be October, April, and October again. So
that's why that's why I think we're saying next June, to give you, to make sure you have opportunities, but I think 2 years of a restriction is...
Two chances if I can't get in on this April, so you won't get that.
Rob thinks...
We can get him in this April if he goes to the site.
Oh, okay.
In the next week or so.
Okay.
Thank you, Rob.
Okay.
Jason, I'll second your motion, but can I suggest a friendly amendment? to it, that we modify the consent agreement to remove the findings of fact and conclusions of law that relate to him aiding and abetting a licensed practice.
Oh, well, that would be in the new consent when they write up, because they'd have to write up a whole brand new consent.
Right. So.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, sir.
With that acknowledgement, then would the administrative penalty be reduced to 1,000 from 2,000?
I'm open to that. It's Jason's motion, but I think that's, since there was two violations and it's one now and he's having to register for the exam and everything else.
Yeah, I'm fine with that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Mr. Winter, do you have that?
Yes. I have one question. I understand the peer review. I get that. Primarily right now, I do not do a lot of design work. I do a lot of failure analysis, and those are far and in between. Majority of the work that I do is render opinions on cause and origin of damage, primarily hail, wind, water intrusion, occasional beam failure here and there. Mm-hmm. But that being said, all of that work is peer-reviewed by other engineers in my office for any of the reports that I do write, and maybe about a handful of jobs per year I am doing currently of structural, and I am not doing any more side work currently. I want to just be upfront.
My thought is someone from your office reviewing it is not a peer review because, you know, they have a conflict of interest. They derive, you know, income from you.
Oh, you haven't met my other peer
review. I know. But I don't think that qualifies.
Okay.
And if you don't do a lot of structural work, then, you wouldn't do three peer reviews. You might just do two. But the point is you have to do peer reviews on three projects. If you do three projects, you need to do it.
Right. Structural projects.
Structural projects.
No, I would say design
well,
work.
Design work. Okay.
Yeah, because just writing an opinion isn't going to matter. So, yeah, it'd have to be a design work. And it's for 18 months, so mm-hmm. it's over the next year and a half to do three design projects. Or even if you're doing a failure analysis where you're providing calculations, I mean, that would be design work as well.
Okay.
I think if you're just rendering opinion on something, then no.
And that's why I wanted to be clear. I just, I want to be up front and tell you that I do a lot. So as long as it's specified in there that it's any structural design review must be peer-reviewed.
Right. And a peer review is going to have to be by an independent, someone independent from your office or, just another licensed structural engineer.
Okay. So, and then I have to pay for that to have them do it, or is there somebody you guys have that I need to send it to? Is that something Mr. Thacker will get with
you
on?
Yeah, I think staff will get with you on that.
Never mind.
Got it.
Mr. Jones?
No.
Okay.
I do have one final question for Mr. Rohr.
Yes, sir.
Were the changes permitted through Maricopa County? You had mentioned that they...
No, they didn't want it. The homeowners went there, had three copies of the calculations, three copies of the drawings, walked into the county and said, we'd like to put in a set of plans for revision because there were some things missed and we did some additional work. And they said, well, the permit's already been closed, thank you and have a good day. And,
is that an issue?
Well, the first issue of the safety of the structure should have been taken care of, so that's most important. But yeah, it potentially is more with the county than anything else. If I were Mr. Orr, I'm not, but I might just send a letter that says, hey, we found these issues, I've remedied them, here's the revisions which were built on the structure, and here's my license, and then it's on the county's
Well, that's what we tried to do by resubmitting the plans, but they didn't want to accept them. And I didn't write a letter because we figured we were resubmitting the plans for them to review and make sure that everything's compliant.
So was the work done in the field to increase the footings and all that?
After we found out that they didn't want the county didn't want the permits, then they got a contractor to complete the work.
Okay, so the work was completed.
Oh yes, absolutely. Okay. So the work was completed after we found out that the county rejected it, and we told the homeowners that this work had to be completed. So They hired a contractor. Contractor went out there, dug in the new footings, and welded the new bars onto that midspan for upland. And that was all taken care of. And that's...
I think that's a county permitting issue at this point in time. If the work was done, I think, you know, him as an engineer is, you know, covered because he designed the work was completed. If the county doesn't want to permit it, that's the county's problem.
Well, it's the owner's problem. If something comes up and somebody says, what's this unpermitted structure?
No, that's just it, though.
Oh,
the structures are already permitted. They were already existing prior to. So when he put in the permit, originally back in last year, in August, and submitted to the county signed off on everything immediately and gave them a permit to get the work, and then they had the work inspected by a third-party inspector from the county, and everything was fine according to the drawings. And
so the project was permitted with the deficient plans, and the county did not comment on the deficient plans?
Yeah, the county didn't even catch it. So obviously, right. You know, where's that, you know, right. Obviously, you know, you say, yes, I missed it, but then the county missed it as well.
So let's build out there is above and beyond what was permitted and approved by the county.
Correct.
So, yeah, that's a non-issue.
Okay, we have a motion on the table. Can anybody read it? It's going to be hard to state, but it's a letter reprimand, a state restriction of structural practice for a period of 18 months or until such a time as the respondent passes the 16-hour structural engineering exam from NCES, three peer reviews of structural design work, an administrative penalty of $1,000, and cost of investigation. And did you say if not signed in 30 days, go to hearing?
Right. Until such time as the respondent passes the 16-hour structural exam. Okay. Yeah, you said or until such time, but it's not or.
It's not or. Until such time.
Right.
Yep, you're correct.
So and removing the portions of the consent agreement regarding, I mean, that's
the aiding and abetting,
the aiding and abetting part.
I'll second.
Okay. So we have a motion and a second. All in favor of the motion?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you, Mr. Orr.
Thank you. I appreciate your time.
Yep. No. Good luck and just pay attention.
Absolutely.
Thanks.
And it won't happen again.
Yeah.
We've had three more solar panels.
Okay, we'll move to agenda item 64, which is case P18057. This is respondent is Larry Walton, PE. And it's regarding the Finney flat channel improvements in Camp Verde, Arizona. It's an expert witness case.
Mr. Chair, I'm recusing myself from this matter. Sorry.
Okay. Thanks, Deborah. Make sure to sign the form.
Done.
You know that. Okay. Is anybody here for this case? Mr. Falk?
Yeah. Good morning, Dr. Angel. And Mr. Welton's here. Larry, you want to come up with the table, please?
Okay, is anybody else here for this case?
The alleger's here.
The alleger's here as well? Would he like to come up? Or just listen in?
I think he's just listening.
Okay. Have a seat, okay. Gentlemen, and please identify yourselves for the board. Thank you for being here.
Yeah. Thank you. Douglas Holt of Clark Hill for Mr. Welton.
Thank you.
I'm Larry Welton.
Thank you, Mr. Walton. Okay, so everybody has the background on the case. Mr. Falk, let me summarize what the investigative conclusions were. Respondent failed to apply the appropriate technical knowledge and skill on this project, and that respondent failed to sign, date, and seal a professional document prepare for dispute resolution, litigation, or mediation. The staff recommendation at this point is a letter of reprimand, a state suspension and probation of 10 months, an administrative penalty of $2,000, and cost of investigation for $850. So Mr. Falk or Mr. Welton, anything you'd like to say to the board?
Well, Yes, thank you for allowing us to address the board today, and I also want to give my apologies in advance. I filed something yesterday late on behalf of Mr. Welton. We were intending to prepare for this meeting today. I had a family emergency come up in early January that took me out of the office for a couple of weeks, and so unfortunately I didn't get things to you in a timely fashion. But I met with Mr. Kramer this morning and explained what we've submitted. Because the board hasn't had an opportunity to review it, I thought this would just be an opportunity for us to present, and then the board could take it up at another date, perhaps at a future meeting. But I'm also wasn't at the EAC meeting, so I've met with Mr. Welton. I've talked with him at some length. I reviewed the file. And the conclusion that we came to and what we're proposing to the board is a revision to the proposed consent order. Mr. Welton is prepared to accept discipline, but we have a concern about the language of the consent order that was presented because it really didn't go far enough, in our view, in stating the facts and the circumstances of his engagement. We were concerned for Mr. Welton and for his employer that if this consent order were signed as presented, it would present an incorrect impression of his state of practice, and it could have an adverse effect on himself and the firm. And so one of the changes that we proposed in the modified order that we returned are some additional findings of fact. I've given Mr. Kramer a red line of the original proposed order, so when you do get a chance to review it, you'll see exactly what we're proposing to add. In the added findings of fact, one of the things that we hope to correct was the impression that the committee appeared to have that Mr. Welton needed to prepare calculations for this engagement. He was hired on very short notice by counsel for the town of Camp Verde to provide an expert opinion. I'm sure many members of this board have heard these conversations before where the lawyer calls up and says, I need something for court in 2 weeks. And Mr. Welton did his best to assist with that. He went out to Camp Verde, he looked at the subject property, he reviewed quite a bit of information which he has provided to the board. One of the documents that he reviewed was a detailed drainage plan, complete with calculations of the drainage. That was the basis for a lot of his professional opinion. So for this assignment, which again was a forensic assignment, he was relying on the work of another registrar. Also, he was asked a very narrow question. The question was, did improvements to the Finney Flat Channel that the town of Camp Verde built cause flooding of the alleger's property? And he answered that question in a draft report, no, they did not. The fact was the property flooded before the channel was improved, and it flooded after the channel was improved. The channel construction itself did not cause flooding to the property, and that was the opinion that Mr. Welton sought to express in his draft report. Now, he provided that to counsel and made some follow-up phone calls to see what additional work was required. He never heard from the attorney after that until he was told the case was settled and the matter's over. What he did not know until he came to the EAC meeting was the lawyer had filed a disclosure statement with the court, which significantly misstated his opinions in the draft report and went far beyond to say other things, which may have been supported by the record, but they were not necessarily Mr. Welton's opinions. And I could understand how the alleger or this committee or this board might think, well, this is pretty alarming here. We've got all these opinions in this disclosure statement. But the fact is, they were not Mr. Welton's opinions, and it was a process that he had no control over. So, to put this all in context, we are proposing to add additional findings of fact that we believe are supported by the record, laying out this history that I just related to you. Mr. Welton believes that it would have been better practice for him to have mentioned in the draft report that he was relying on the drainage study that was done for this project before it was built. That was omitted.
And again, it was this mad rush to get a report together. On reflection, he realizes it would have been better practice to put that in. So with that in mind, he's prepared to accept a consent order with a finding of a violation of R-4301-6 for technical knowledge and skill. The last point that we've asked for modification on concerns the second conclusion of law, and this was the first time I'd ever seen the committee recommend this or the board consider it, but the committee or the board appears to be saying in their draft that an unsigned, an incomplete draft expert report must also be sealed. And I'm reverse engineering this process, but thinking, well, they must have keyed on this language in all cases. And as I've submitted in a letter I've given to the board, I believe that's an incorrect application of the rule. The two parts of that rule, D1 and D2, need to be read in context with each other. The first subpart says that any draft or preliminary work that is not sealed has to be labeled as such. His report was labeled draft on every page. And we believe that the second subpart, B2, only applies to final work product that is submitted in a dispute resolution process, whether that's a hearing, a mediation, an arbitration, or a court trial. Mr. Welton's draft report was never filed with the court, and certainly he never released it for the purpose of being filed with the court. So we respectfully submit that we believe that would be in error. We've asked that that be deleted from the consent order, but otherwise the reprimand, the administrative penalty, and the cost of investigation would remain as proposed by the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Polk. Any thoughts from the board?
That's the main thing issue I had with this case was that someone would take a draft report and file a complaint when it mm-hmm. wasn't, when it was obviously a draft report, and we all know if the final report is stamped and sealed, and yours was a draft, and I think that is, and I agree with Mr. Polk, that's an error. The complaint, I think I agree with you that it should be dismissed, that particular part of it.
Yeah, I also concur that the conclusions of law should not include anything about not sealing the report, because it's clearly marked the draft. So I think that part of the case is, in my mind, very clear.
Very clear.
Mr. Polk, do you? The other part of the case about the technical skill, I'm not persuaded that just having a short timeline is reason to do a poor job. And to be honest, I mean, when I read the drainage report or the opinion of Mr. Welton, he disagreed with the other report but didn't provide any specifics or reasons why he did so. I know it's not a final report, but it's becoming public once he releases it, you know, for use. So I think Mr. Wallen, and I think he knows that, should have done a better job of reviewing it. He even said, and this is what he told the EAC, said he would not testify to half of what he said in the report. So I think definitely requires better care of those products.
And Dr. Angel, no disagreement here. We're not offering up as an excuse the short time frame. Again, that just provided context for how this process seemed to run away after he had delivered the draft report. So I won't comment further on the Pender report. It said a lot of things too, mm-hmm. with no calculations to back it up. And that was something that Mr. Welton was also responding to. So. My layperson's view is it's a very complicated area up here around Finney Flat Road in this channel. It was a project that the town of Camp Verde was intending to improve the drainage in the area by building it. The alleger was not satisfied at first with what the town did. I don't know how that case was resolved, but our understanding is it was resolved. So we've laid it out. Not offering any excuses. As I said, if the board sees fit to accept the modifications that we've proposed, Mr. Welton has reviewed the draft that I submitted, and he would be willing to sign that as a consent order.
Any discussion?
Yeah, I mean, just for discussion, Mr. Chairman, it excuse my expression, but it kind of, you know, that kind of legal or...
Gene, I think they might have trouble hearing you in the back. If you can, I can hear you fine, but...
The type of logic that the attorney had described where Mr. Welton answered the question that was asked. Did our improvements somehow
result
in flooding? And the answer was no, but it was crouched in the fact it was flooding before and it was flooding after. One would tend to believe that an improvement by the town would have enhanced drainage capability, and your review at least should conclude that it was inadequate. Whether the improvement was made in such a way that it did not, I think he used words to the extent similar to what occurred prior. In other words, nothing changed. Everything this was after in terms of flooding on this gentleman's property occurred the same way before or after the town's work. I would have thought somewhere to find that the town's work did not enhance the design. It actually was ineffective.
Yeah, what we don't know is maybe the intent of this project was not to fix the flooding problems on that property. Maybe it was for downstream property.
It might have been the culvert. Might have been the choke point where the drainage was insufficient for the overall area that was trying to be taken care of. I'm not an expert enough on that topic. The drainage calculations would document or determine that finding. But again, I would have thought that the engineer would have been clearer in the statement about what the actual outcome of the review was.
Well, I'd like to back up to sometime in the last year or two when we had a discussion about expert witnesses and engineers and what we can regulate, what we think certain practices are. Are we consistent, or do we feel like we're acting consistent with whatever that decision was that was rendered about our conduct towards expert witnesses, or are we looking a little bit too much in detail with this? Or I personally, I thought that we were put in a position or maybe recommended to examine things a little more hands-off regarding what happens in court. Now, I'm not saying that's an excuse for anybody to do whatever they want, but it sure is a different venue being in a courtroom and being an expert witness than it is going out and working for a client and doing a design. So,
I think that's an excellent point. I think so. We had adopted a policy for expert witnesses to have to be registered in the state, and we rescinded that policy for partially those reasons. But I think it's okay to have different opinions that are supported by fact in court, and then I think we're hands off. But if your opinion should be supported in some professional way. So if you do something negligent in court, I think that's something you'll still be thinking about.
Well, I don't know that. I think that's settled in court, though. I think that there's competing opinions, and one's going to be more appropriate, if that's the word. So I don't know that us deciding one is better than the other, or if the court chooses one over the other. I still think that we look at both of those opinions in the same light. So one is better than the other, and okay, they were issued in the court, and the court used those.
Right, I think the court is responsible for deciding which side prevails, not just on the expert witness account, but on everything else. And they're tasked with deciding who's an expert witness for the purposes of the court and all of that. I don't think that means registrants have carte blanche to do whatever they want and say whatever they want, because that does affect the public.
And I would probably say the opposite of that. They're probably limited to only what's brought in by the court, correct? So maybe they're inhibited in some way from doing what they might normally do.
It's all defined by standard practice, though, still.
Carmen?
I was just thinking, in this case, I think we've all sort of agreed that if the draft was submitted to court, not stamped and signed, that wasn't this gentleman's fault. And so is there a way to direct staff to work with him on a new consent agenda? What would be our direction at this time?
Yeah, my understanding is we're not, taking action today. We're directing staff. And I think the one thing, correct me, anybody, if we're wrong, but it's that we agree that the conclusion of law that the report should have been signed is not appropriate, and we want to take that out.
No, I don't agree with that.
Oh, you don't agree with it? You think it should have been signed?
I think the use of seals. I respectfully disagree with Mr. Folk on D2, and I'd like to kind of get Mr. Donald's opinion on this, too. I mean, D2 reads, in all cases, it's a separate item, line item from D1. It's D2, in all cases. If the document is prepared for the purpose of dispute resolution, litigation, arbitration, or mediation, it's supposed to be sealed, regardless of it being a draft or a preliminary or anything else. And I think the reason that I had a discussion with Ron Starling, who was on the board when this was adopted, was for this very reason, that you might give a report to an attorney and it ends up as part of a brief or something that, you have no control over. My reading of this is in all cases means in all cases, not if it's marked preliminary or draft or anything else. And Scott, I mean, kind of like your opinion on that too, on your interpretation of it.
Certainly. Ultimately, the interpretation of the statute is going to be up to the board. In terms of whether D2 encompasses something that is kind of a preliminary, something that's not intended for use in dispute resolution, litigation, arbitration, or mediation at that point, it's just sort of to give the guy an indication of what direction you're thinking is. That's a question of whether the board interprets D2 to mean that. I can't tell you. I can't make that decision for the board. D2, in all cases, if the document is prepared for the purposes of, could certainly extend to work papers. It could extend to notes. It could extend to any documents that he's preparing along the way, theoretically. Or it could extend solely to a final product document that's being prepared for the purposes of dispute resolution, for example, a final report, so that the board is going to have to determine in practice what you guys think, how you interpret the statute in terms of the documents that you're using in preparing for dispute resolution, litigation, arbitration, or mediation. How far does prepared for the purpose of extend?
In practicality, how do you do a QA set or communicate with your client? I would feel extremely uncomfortable stamping and signing something that was not fully QA'd, but then how do I print a QA and get my client's feedback? I don't know if testimony is totally different than that, but in the practice of architecture, I do 20 sets that aren't stamped and signed, and I can't stamp and sign them until I QA them.
Right, but are they part of a dispute resolution or
what's in the preparation of getting there versus what's the final product? Is that what, I think that's what we're talking about.
Part of the difference, potentially, I think, is that in the dispute resolution, they're asking for your expert professional opinion only, and your client, in theory, should not be directing you what to put in the report.
True.
So you can do QA, but you can do it, internally or other ways. And once you submit your professional opinion, it's your professional opinion already.
Right, and that goes to this case, and especially, what the respondent said was, I wouldn't testify to half of what I put in my letter. That's concerning. I mean, you know, just because you put draft on something doesn't, you know, I don't believe you should just be able to just write whatever you want, you know, without some kind of, you know, backing up on it. At the very least, you know, referencing the, you know, calculations that were completed by someone else and saying, you know, based on our review of blah, blah, blah,
right.
You know, my opinion is this. You could seal that, you know, because, you know, that, you know, and if it turned out that, you know, what you based your opinion on was faulty, well, then, you know, you can say, well, but it was based on this. That's a problem I have with this, because this attorney took this draft document that wasn't sealed and used it, you know, for his brief, you know, unbeknownst to the respondent, but still, it was done. And it seems like this kind of went down this path based on that, you know, based on that letter where, you know, had he had to seal it, I think you'd probably have taken a little bit more care in writing it.
And doing the QA.
The right, court
so you can't just hide behind, it was a draft, I have, you know, I'm not responsible for any of it.
Yeah, that does not excuse.
I think, though, the court takes it either way, right? They're just taking this document. It doesn't break the document or the information, does it, because it's sealed or not sealed. I mean, he's got it marked draft, so he knew that it was some draft. But when the court accepts this, they take it either way, right? They just take the information that's in there.
They take that as the opinion of an expert, whether it's stamped or not.
Yeah, I mean, they vet that.
Which is the problem.
And that's what the attorney wrote the brief on. You know,
but just the fact that it was typed as a draft, I would think the attorney should be cautious about how much weight he puts into a draft report.
Well, yes, but that's something different.
Mr. Falk, did you have a comment on this discussion?
If I may.
Absolutely.
And I'd like to also, if I could, respond to Mr. Montgomery's comment earlier. I want to talk about Mr. Madison's comment first. I respectfully submit that it would be not a good practice for the board to require draft expert reports to be sealed. This practice of requiring a professional seal is very serious. It goes to the heart of the profession to signify that professional has reached a conclusion to a degree of reasonable certainty based on the work that they did. If the board would require a practice of professionals issuing out draft documents and sealing them so that these documents could then be disseminated, you're opening the door for experts to walk back opinions all the time. They could easily issue a draft report, seal it, their client does whatever they want with it, and then when the facts are further developed and they may have reason to rethink the opinion, they say, oh, well, that was just a draft report. That would play havoc with the legal process if the board were to encourage that practice.
But Mr. Falk, isn't that what we have in this specific case, that it was labeled draft, so therefore it really didn't have to be ready?
No, that wasn't the case here. And again, I wasn't there. I'm going on the information that Mr. Welton gave me, but the things that I've represented to the board today are apparent in the file that was provided to you. He's giving you documents. He's giving you a statement. He because it was a commission on such short notice, he sent the draft to the attorney that hired him, expecting to have a further conversation. That never happened, but it wasn't because of what Mr. Welton did or didn't do. The lawyer never returned his phone calls. It's reported that there was one further notice that a trial date had been set, and then the only other communication after that was the case is settled. Nobody explained to Mr. Welton how it had been settled. Now, again, putting this in the context of his assignment, you have his letter of engagement in your file that explains what he was hired to do. It was also within his scope, once he got sufficient information, to recommend remedial measures. And even in the draft report, he doesn't say there's no problem here. He says there could be improvements to the drainage from the alleger's property because the 18-inch pipe was not draining it adequately. And he gave two recommendations, either add a pipe or put a float one-way valve so it wouldn't backflow in from the ditch when the ditch is running full. Those were never followed up by anybody. So at least there's a recognition, this is what the file shows, that Mr. Welton was aware that the property was not draining after draining as promptly as anyone would like it, and that something should be done about that. And he offered his professional assistance to do it, but it wasn't taken. Now here's my point about my response, if I could, to Mr. Montgomery's concern. There is a risk in trying to evaluate these files for forensic engineers to read too much into what you have. This is not a developed file. You don't have a full set of facts here. There are a lot of things suggesting how things happen. We know that Mr. Welton did not design the improvements to the Finney Flat Ditch. Cantbury hired another engineer to do that. They relied on another engineer's report. The town made decisions about what it could afford to do, and there is a mention in the file that this was a regional improvement. They talked about creating additional detention on a Catholic church property that's farther upstream from the alleged site that, for all we know, have contributed to an improvement because they meter out the flow and it reduces that peak discharge hitting the alleged property. These are suggested in the file. The only thing that Mr. Welton was asked to opine on is, did the construction of these particular improvements cause flooding or aggravate flooding on this property? And he that's as far as he got. So that's all the file that we have. And so I would again caution the board about speculating, well, why didn't Mr. Welton do more or why didn't he say more? He did point out that there's a problem here and he offered to do something about it, but the client that hired him did not take the service. So that brings us back to where we end up. We acknowledge the deficiencies in the draft report. He's prepared to sign a consent order and accept the board's discipline, and we submit that's the right outcome.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Polk. I appreciate your input. I think, would everybody be okay if we took an executive session? I think to discuss one of the items in this case. Would anybody move it?
I would make a motion that we go to executive session.
Thank you. Do we have a second?
Second.
Would that be for legal advice?
For legal advice, Mr. Donald.
For legal advice.
Thank you. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Thank you. Hopefully it'll be a short session, everybody. Thank you.